This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. American history, what we choose to remember and celebrate, is as important as what we choose to sweep under the rug and forget and pretend like it never actually happened. And that's what would have happened with the story of the Groveland Boys in Florida in 1949. That's when Jim Crow was in full force trying to rein in African-American males who came back from the war with ideas of equality. Gilbert King looks under that rug of history and found this one of many stories of racial injustice, bizarre twists with heroic figures and terrible villains. He investigated, wrote about it with a clear, compelling narrative, and won the 2013 Pulitzer for nonfiction. The book is Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall and the Groveland Boys and the Dawn of a New America. He's also, Gilbert King is doing a reading and book signing tonight at Incarnate Word University. That's at 7:30 at the McCombs Center at the Rosenberg Sky Room. It's free and open to the public. And Gilbert King, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thanks, David.
And we invite our callers to join the conversation. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource at tpr.org and go to the comments section on our website at tpr.org. So, Gilbert, let me ask you about the book. You won the Pulitzer for this. That is like, you know, you did it. You
yeah.
got the
big one, right?
And you didn't even know that the book had been nominated, and you just got it out of the blue. That dude, Pulitzer.
Yeah, and that's sort of the strange thing, and people don't really believe it. They must say, "Oh, you must have known you were nominated. You must have known you were in the running." I didn't know anything. I didn't even know I was eligible. I didn't even know my publisher had submitted this. They don't tell you that, and I can understand why a publisher wouldn't tell you that, because you know 30 of their authors are going to go, "God, I didn't get it." You know, so they don't even tell you. And it just sort of came out of the blue for me. I mean, I was as surprised as anybody, believe me. It was just one of those things I was never expecting. I always said this is sort of the thing that happens to other writers. And so I was out playing golf with a friend and I got this text, and I still didn't believe it when I saw the text. I thought it was alerting to me, to another friend of mine who'd won for fiction. And I'm reading the text going, "Oh, all right, Adam won for fiction. That's fantastic." And the next sentence literally said, "Gilbert King won for nonfiction, Devil in the Grove." And I was just really shocked by it. And then right after that, my phone started blowing up, as the kids say. And I said, "I guess it's a real story."
Now, I read this somewhere, and I don't believe it. So tell me if it's true or not. You failed high school English?
I wouldn't say I failed. I think I got a D-, and they said, "You really ought to go to summer school if you want to graduate." So...
So how does a professional writer, winner of the Pulitzer, you know, what happened there?
You know, I think it was a matter of I wasn't applying myself, as my teacher said. And I was always staring out the windows, thinking of other things, doing other things. And I liked to read as a young, but I didn't really have any discipline to do a lot of work. I was sort of in my own little world in high school. That was my problem. Probably they would have a medicine for that nowadays. Back then they didn't.
Yes. Okay. So... Two good books that you've written. Of course, this one you got the Pulitzer for, and then the previous book about Willie Francis.
Right, right.
And about the only man who was ever executed twice.
Right.
Or he was sent to the electric chair twice.
Right.
So, and one led to the other. Tell me, so that kind of gave you the foundation to write Groveland. So let's talk about Groveland. Let's unpack it and explain it for the listeners. What is this book about?
Well, the Groveland story is the story about, it's a very much like a To Kill a Mockingbird type story, where you have a 17-year-old farm girl all of a sudden in the middle of 1949 come up with the accusations that she had been raped by four African-Americans. And so within 24 hours, the Klan rolls into town from all these different counties, and they start burning down the black community, scaring off every African-American into the swamps. And so it just became this gigantic, what they called a race riot at the time. It wasn't really much of a riot. It was more of a raising of the black section of town. And after that, they identified four suspects. They quickly arrested three of them, took them down into the basement of the jailhouse and beat confessions out of them. And so the sheriff stood on the courthouse stairs and said, "This case will be over very quickly. We just have confessions. We know who did this."
Because the Klan wanted to lynch those men right then and right there.
Exactly. They were going to take it into their own hands. And in fact, Sheriff Willis McCall, who's a very large figure in the book starts the story out by preventing a lynching. He just says, you know, these guys are going to go to trial. They confessed. We're not going to have a lynching in my county. And he actually protects them from a lynching.
And he's a hero for that.
He is. He's on the front page of all these newspapers across the country. The New York Times is writing about the fast-talking sheriff who saved these African Americans. And, you know, for about a week or so, he was a progressive hero, you might say. Until things sort of took a turn for the worse. But at that point, he was really just trying to preserve law and order in his town. He just didn't want to have a lynching.
So, but the 17-year-old said she was raped by four men.
Right.
One, and so these four men, they had like – one of them had a pretty good alibi. He was in jail at the time.
Yeah, one of them had a very solid alibi.
So, I mean, it seemed like this was not they didn't do it.
It was pretty obvious that – you know, two of them were in the area at the time. The other two were not. So this one kid, a 16-year-old kid named Charles Greenlee, he was picked up for loitering charges. He had just come into town to be a citrus picker, and he was sleeping in a train station that night, and he got picked up around midnight and taken into a jail. And so by everyone's account, even the victim's account, this rape had taken place somewhere after 1 a.m., because that's when they left the dance floor. So they knew that he was accounted for in the jail at that time. But strangely enough, the power in Lake County was pretty much if the sheriff said this happened and this kid was involved, and if this victim was able to say, yes, that was him, that was enough. And all you had to do is convince 12 white farmer jurors. And so the timeline that the defense presented just didn't make any difference. It was the word of a white woman against the word of some black men, and it was pretty obvious.
So four men accused, only three survived to even make it to the first night in jail.
Right. You know, the fourth suspect, Ernest Thomas, he saw what was happening. He saw these guys picked up by the police. He knew exactly what was going to happen. He fled, and he went up to the swamps and was living in the swamps for a week or so, and then a sheriff sent up a posse of about 1,000 men, and they just hunted him down and killed him, filled his body with bullets. In fact, they were pretty clear, the FBI reports, they could have captured this guy if they wanted to. But apparently, according to Sheriff McCauley, he was really not going to come back alive.
And these men, they didn't really know each other?
No. In fact, Walter Irvin and Samuel Shepard were the two military guys. They knew each other. They were best friends. So they knew each other. But the 16-year-old kid had no idea who these people were. And the next thing you know, he's in the basement chained up to the pipes with handcuffs, just having, you know, his body just beaten mercilessly with these guys he's never seen. And he confessed to the crime just to stop the beating.
So we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking about the book that won the 2013 Pulitzer for nonfiction, Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. We've got the author, the winner of the Pulitzer with us in the studio, Gilbert King. We want to hear your calls. Give us a call in at 614-8980, 614-8980. Also, he is going to be doing a reading and a book signing tonight at Incarnate Word University at 7:30 at the McComb Center, Rosenberg Sky Room, free and open to the public. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The book, The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. It won the 2013 Pulitzer for nonfiction. The author is Gilbert King. He's in San Antonio right now. He's going to be doing a book signing and reading tonight at Incarnate Word University. That's free and open to the public at 7:30 at the McComb Center Rosenberg Sky Room. So, Gilbert, we haven't even gotten to Thurgood Marshall yet. The scene right now is we've got these the three of the four young men who are now in jail, accused of raping this woman. And when does Marshall show up?
Well, what's really interesting is Marshall is sort of in New York the whole time, sort of anchoring and sort of pulling the strings on the trial. And he sends down these young African-American lawyers to run the case.
So he's with what organization?
He's with the NAACP up in New York. And so he's the head of the Legal Defense Fund, which is, you know, they're the legal end of the NAACP. And so he sends down some young attorneys to do this case. And these guys get back to him, and they're scared out of their mind. There's Klansmen everywhere. They can't get anything done. They can't go into the county to even interview witnesses because they're just being threatened constantly. And they all writing back to Marshall saying, this is a very dangerous place for us. We don't feel very comfortable. And they're rushing this trial and they're hiding witnesses from us. And, you know, what happened was they sent Norma Padgett, the 17-year-old girl, to a physician for a post-rape examination. And then Sheriff McCall goes to visit the doctor, and the doctor doesn't find any evidence of a rape. And so they hide him from the defense, and they're not going to call him as a witness anymore. So all these exculpatory evidence is being hidden from the defense. And Marshall's just sort of sitting up in New York wondering what's going on down there. How can this be happening? And so the first trial is just a disaster for the defense. They really can't call any witnesses. They don't have time to put a case together. They can't get any licensed Florida attorneys to help take the case because you have to be registered with the Florida bar. So they find someone, Alex Ackerman, to come in, but they really just don't have a time to defend these guys. And the case ends sort of predictably, like To Kill a Mockingbird. 12 men need about an hour to convict. And so that's when the story sort of really starts to take a turn for the worse.
But Marshall is already preparing for the appeal.
Right. The whole time they're appealing because, you know, Marshall and his lawyers knew that there's no way you're going to win these cases. They knew for a fact that there's no way they're going to convince 12 jurors, reasonable doubt or anything like that. So what they're doing is they're looking at the prosecution's case and seeing all the mistakes that they make. And that's where the NAACP was really strong. They knew exactly what things the Supreme Court had already ruled on that were not going to be accepted if they could appeal it to a higher court. And so the first verdict comes back not guilty. Marshall sees that there's three or four different appealable things that they could win on. They take it to the Florida State Supreme Court. They reject it, of course. Then it goes to the Supreme Court. And that's where Marshall enters the case. And he comes in and very quickly convinces the Supreme Court that this was an abomination. In fact, Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson calls it the biggest example of one of the worst menaces to American justice. And they overturn the verdict. And basically they say you can't pick jurors the way that the prosecution was picking, which was handpicking them. He would go out and select certain what he called, quote, good Negroes, and pick these guys to sit on the jury and then excuse them with peremptory challenges. And so they were getting rid of all the African-American jurors that way, just handpicking them and then excusing them. And so Marshall easily wins this before the Supreme Court, and that's when the verdict gets overturned unanimously.
So there's a lot more to the story, another more twist, but I want to set the scene a little bit more,
sure.
Particularly when they considered two of the Groveland boys to be troublemakers because they would wear their military uniforms around town.
Right.
Why is that a troublemaker? What was happening at the time around the South?
Well, what happened is after World War II, you had a lot of African-American servicemen who served either in Germany or they served in Europe. A lot of them were based in France. And they would get a taste for a little more freedom. It was a little bit more liberating for them to be in France, to actually engage socially with French citizens and be treated in a more equal way. And then after the war, they would come back to the United States, to the South, and sort of be ushered and expected to slip quietly back into Jim Crow.
Right. I remember a story that Freddie Fender once told me, you know, the musician, and he had joined the Marines as a child. And he said that he was in basic, and someone came up, an officer came up to him and said, stand up straight. You know, Americans don't stand around with your hands in your pockets. And he said, this is the first time anyone ever called him an American. And he was just taken aback by it. And he remembered it for the rest of his life. So it's just one of these, you know, you get into the military, you get treated with with some respect and an opportunity to show your what you can do. And then you go back to the South and during Jim Crow, and you may not want to go back to that way of life.
Not at all. And if you were participating as a member of the armed services, you had sergeants and superior officers treating you with certain respect. If you did follow the rules, you were any every other American. But they would come back into the South and it would be like, boy this, boy that, stand aside when we're walking. It was things that they didn't have to adhere to in the military. And law enforcement was doing this to them and sort of making an example, like, don't think you're special just because you serve the country. You're still black. And that was the message they were getting.
And so there were lynchings, widespread lynchings.
In 1946, they called it the horrible summer of 46, where there were soldier lynchings. And military men, black military men, were being lynched in their uniforms, being dumped in swamps, strung from trees. And it was a real big problem. And that was one of the cases that one of the summers that Marshall was really the most active, because there was this wave of soldier lynchings. And it was all because these guys were sort of coming back saying, you know, we're going to wear our uniforms just to remind people that we are Americans. We're not going to wear street civilian clothes. And you were allowed to, if you served in the military, you were allowed for, I think, the next 9 months, you were allowed to wear your uniform by law when you came back. And so they would do this. And this was seen as a very uppity, provocative thing to do in the Jim Crow South.
And Thurgood Marshall, of course, was he a national figure at the time still? Because this is way before, this is not yet Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
And many people may know of him as the Supreme Court Chief Justice who was so, led the court in changing many of our civil rights. But he was right now, he was in the trenches.
He was. And the thing is, he'd already become sort of a national celebrity. Before Brown versus Board, he'd already had some landmark decisions in voting rights cases, in housing cases, and he was known as Mr. Civil Rights. So he was pretty well known, but it was still the years before Brown, before he was a household name, and he was still going down south, taking the trains by himself.
Taking the trains in the Jim Crow compartments, in the segregated.
Right. Sometimes he would say he'd, have to sit on caskets with the rest of the porters, like that was his seat for the whole ride, while they were transporting, the bodies of black men between states. And that's where they put African Americans. So he's sitting back there going down to practice law in the South. And it was a very treacherous time. They'd have to move him from house to house because the Klan would literally be searching for him. They didn't really appreciate what they called, black men talking back to judges as if they were white, wearing suits. And that was, Marshall got a lot of grief for that. And it was a very dangerous thing. He would be protected around the clock by the black communities because they knew he was like the only lawyer who would really save their kids from certain death.
Or an indispensable individual. Anything had happened to him at that point, you can imagine what the parallel history might have looked like.
No, I mean, he was the one that was really the architect behind the Brown versus Board and the desegregation of the schools. And at this time in Groveland, when this case started, they were just starting Brown. So those cases were being argued at this time. And a lot of people, his own advisors, were like, Zergin, you can't go down there. This is like there's bombings constantly. Florida was a very violent place back then, in the late 40s and early 50s. It sort of stayed under the radar. But there were bombings of churches constantly, lots of killings, Klan killings. The Klan was bigger in Florida than it was in any other state in the South. And people just don't realize how violent the place was. And they didn't want Marshall going down there. But, he was of the opinion that these cases were important, just as important as voting rights, because they saved people's lives. And he was committed to them.
Now, let's talk a little about the citrus industry there and how their labor pool and what they depended on and some of the tactics that they used to get people to pick the oranges.
Right. And so this story takes place in Lake County, which is at the time, after World War II, it sort of exploded. There was the birth of concentrated orange juice. And so all of a sudden you had these groves just making a ton of money. And you had these citrus barons who had put this sheriff into office. And the biggest expense that they had in these citrus groves was the labor. That was the most expensive cost that they had. And there was always a shortage because now they were spraying with DDT, so more of the crops were healthy. And labor was a problem. And so what they did was they enacted these worker fight laws during World War II. And it basically allowed the sheriff to arrest anyone who wasn't either in the army or picking citrus. And so if you happen to be on a street corner on a Saturday afternoon, the sheriff, by law, had the right to pick you up and throw you in jail. And they would keep you in jail, and then they would get on the phone with a foreman of a grove and say, we got 7 bodies here, and you can have them. And that's how they sort of controlled a very cheap labor force, by just picking people up, throwing them in jail, and making them work off the fines. The strange thing about it was the law also allowed the sheriff to keep the fines. So the sheriff had total motivation to go out and pick people up because he was getting to keep the fines from the groves.
And the sheriff in Lake County, Sheriff McCall, We talked about him earlier.
Right.
And he's the one who stood up to the lynchers and said, you cannot have these men. They're going to go to trial. Turns out he was not the progressive figure that we thought he was.
Not at all. In fact, I think what happened was he made this implicit bargain with the people of Lake County that you're not going to lynch anybody, but we're sending these guys to the electric chair, and it's going to happen fast. And so when the Supreme Court overturned this, that was an affront to him. Marshall was like stepping on his turf. And it was Thurgood Marshall that was responsible for his change in fortune. And so he had promised the people of Lake County that he was going to have these rapists killed. And now the Supreme Court, the agitators from the north, were coming down to, you know, get justice. And so...
So here comes the big twist.
Here comes.
You know, so actually we get the Supreme Court says we got to get a new trial for these two surviving. And so the sheriff is going to transport them back,
right.
And then something happens.
Right. So Sheriff McCall says he's personally going to go up to Rayford and pick up these two prisoners and bring them back down for the new trial. He picks them up with a deputy in another car. He sends the deputy ahead a little bit, and then he takes a strange turn down a dirt road, and he's got these two guys cuffed in the car, and he basically just pulls over. And the next thing you know, he's on the radio saying, get back here. We had a prison escape, but they jumped me. And the deputy comes back. Witnesses come back, and they find two bodies laying in
the ditch.
They look like they're shot dead. And McCall, his clothes are torn. He's bleeding from his head, and he's saying, yeah, they tried to jump me, but I fixed them real good. It was either them or me. I had to do it. They were going for my gun.
But it's not like what it seems, and one of them is not dead.
Right. And that's the strangest part of it all. Walter Irvin was laying there pretending to be dead, and he later regains consciousness and has a very different story to tell.
And so now Thurgood Marshall is going to come down to Lake County himself, represent him in trial, and the story begins anew. Okay, we're going to continue the conversation, and we're going to need you to call in. I'm sure you've got questions about this. It's a pretty interesting story. 614-8980, 614-8980. But we got to do NPR News first, but you're listening to The Source on KSTX. When we come back, we continue our conversation with Gilbert King. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX, and we are continuing our conversation with Gilbert King. He is the author who won the Pulitzer Prize for 2013 nonfiction for the book Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall and the Groveland Boys and the Dawn of a New America. So far, we have been trying to unwind this story. It's a bizarre story, plenty of twists and turns. Where we left off, we found that the Sheriff McCall had thwarted the attempted escape of two of the prisoners who had been accused of a 1949 rape of a 17-year-old girl in Lake Florida.
Right.
So one of the prisoners, he shot them both.
Right.
One is dead on arrival right there. The other one's still breathing. And he's standing over them with the photographers, and everyone's going, and someone says, he's still alive.
Right, which I think is like one of the most amazing true crime photographs I've ever seen, is that, you know, McCall obviously set this up. He wanted to be standing there looking bloodied and messy, and the photographers flash fires. And one of the witnesses, hey, that guy's still moving. And I think that came as a big surprise to McCall at that point, because I don't think he really wanted to have someone who survived this shooting still around.
So the survivor is going to be put back on trial.
Right. So what's amazing is they bring Walter Irvin back to the hospital, and he's got three bullet holes in him. And McCall has already given his statement to the media saying that they attacked him and they were pulling his hair and he was shooting as he was retreating. Marshall comes down to the hospital, and they go into the room with Walter Irvin, who's beginning to regain consciousness, and there's reporters there, and Walter Irvin tells a completely different story, said it was a tale of cold-blooded murder, there was no escape, and he describes how the shooting happened, and then he says something that's, you know, was absolutely chilling to everybody in the room. He said, you know, I was laying there with two bullets, McCall got on the radio, called his deputy back. The deputy came back with his flashlight, starts shining it down, and he says, this one's still alive. Pulls out his own gun and fires point blank right through Walter Irvin's neck. And so the deputy actually came back and tried to kill him. And so when he says this, there's like a gasp in the hospital room, and Marshall's looking around at the other people in the room going, can you believe that what this story is? And the FBI happens to be in the room, and they hear this story, and immediately they think, well, if Irvin's story's right and he's shot point blank while he's laying on the ground, let's go back to the scene. And they go back to this crime scene, and they start digging underneath that blood spot, and that's where they find the sixth bullet. And it was 10 inches into the soil. So they knew that Walter Irvin's story was correct. And so that's the point where everyone's, even the defense attorney starts to say, we got an out of control sheriff here. Or I mean, the prosecuting attorney. The reporters are beginning to question it. Marshall knows now that these guys are absolutely innocent. And so the story sort of takes a strange turn from there, because they're still going to put Walter Irvin on trial for his life.
The prosecutor, you bring him up. So he starts out the story as he felt that he was part of the righteous effort to, you know, maintain peace and stability in the county. Later, as he has an awakening that there is a problem here, and maybe he has been fighting on the wrong side.
Right. And that was what was most amazing to me, is just finding that, you know, the prosecutor who was really prosecuting this case in a very vigorous way, really just using every technique, prosecutorial misconduct constantly. But after that shooting, he starts to have a little change of heart, and he's starting to see, he recognizes that McCall is lying. And so he starts to doubt everything about McCall's case, about the entire story. And strangely enough, the prosecutor, Jesse Hunter, begins leaking things to Thurgood Marshall in the middle of the case. So he's still prosecuting, and yet he's giving information to Marshall, because he's trying to rectify this in his conscience. It was just a striking thing that I found in the files. I just couldn't believe it was happening.
Our phone number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Gilbert King is in the studio. He is the author of the book, The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall and the Groveland Boys and the Dawn of a New America. Why is this the dawn of a new America?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think what happened is, When I talk about this case or with people who have read the book, one of the things they always say, I can't believe this was happening in America. I can't believe prosecutors could do this. I didn't know you could hide
evidence. I mean, it reads like fiction.
Yeah. And I think a part of that reason is people are very sophisticated. They watch court TV. They see these big trials. They sort of have a very good understanding with how the justice system works, and that you have to turn over exculpatory evidence. You can't bring witnesses who lie. You can't do all these things that were happening in this Groveland case. And so they can't really believe that this was part of our justice system, you know, only 50 years ago. And I think that's part of Marshall's legacy, is that for a lot of his decisions, you know, you can't have coerced confessions be brought into evidence. All these things that people know today were part of a legal strategy in the South just 50 years ago. And so it really is the very beginning of a new form of justice that you were starting to see in the courts. And so we sort of look at it as the dawn of a new America, where, you know, now Americans take jury duty pretty seriously. You still have your aberrations of certain verdicts that you find hard to believe. But for the most part, the level of justice that's practiced throughout America is much different than it was just 50 years ago in the South.
So Thurgood Marshall, he later goes on to Brown versus the Board of and he goes before the Supreme Court and does that, argues that he's been before the Supreme Court, what, like 30 times?
Right. Marshall had an unbelievable, he was 32, he had, of the 32 cases that he brought before the Supreme Court, he won 29 of them. And so I started immediately looking at, well, what are the three that he lost, you know, just out of curiosity. And I looked at him, I was like, he actually should have won those cases too. Like, everything was in place. Prior decisions, and they were just, for some strange political reason, you know, there was one where Justice Douglas was thinking about being on a ticket with Roosevelt, and so they thought that he changed his vote to sort of appeal to the South. So a case that Marshall knew he always voted a certain way, one of the cases he just kind of turned it around. And so he lost these cases, which he really should have won consistency-wise.
He was a figure larger than life. But you still, I mean, you're not tearing him down in the story, but you present him as a human,
right,
but still a very heroic human.
Yeah, you know, I really wanted to be honest with him. I didn't really want to I kept looking for things that would sort of make it interesting, those sort of gray areas. You know, definitely he liked to drink. He traveled on the road. He was sort of known as a ladies' woman. So I really don't shy away from that. I mean, there were big struggles that he had. He really wanted a family, and yet his wife was unable to have children, and then she later got sick and died of cancer shortly after this case. So his life was not one of like pure sainthood. Yet on the other hand, I had a chance to go through these files and I kept finding instances where he was maybe took a shortcut here and there. And yet it was always his younger lawyers who were advising them to try to find these shortcuts or maybe to do things a little differently that would work out easier for them. And Marshall was always adamant about, no, we cannot do any of that stuff because this organization cannot afford to make one little mistake. And so they were really adamant about sort of, you know, taking a very straight road and never doing anything that even looked close to unethical. So in a way, he was overseeing this legal defense fund that was just really the best and the brightest of these young lawyers, and they really couldn't afford to lose ever.
Do you think enough people today know who Thurgood Marshall was? I mean, has he been forgotten largely?
I don't think he's been forgotten, but I think he's sort of thought of as this cranky old Supreme Court justice who later on started to see the court take a more conservative turn. And so all he was doing was writing dissents, protesting the kind of decisions that, you know, he was able to win 10 and 20 years ago. And so they have this vision of him as sort of a cranky old guy, but he wasn't.
All right, we're going to continue the conversation. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 614-8980, 614-8980. We've got Gilbert King in the studio talking about his book, Devil in the Grove. This is The Source on KSTX. We will be right back.
Do you think that President Eisenhower, Mr. Marshall, has done all that he can thus far to further the cause of integration? And what I mean is in practice as well as in speech, as well as in trying to create a restrained but favorable national attitude.
Well, I do not think that President Eisenhower has done anywhere near what he could have done. I wonder whether it's too late. I don't think it's too late. But I think the president should have shortly after the decisions, or at least by now, have gotten on a television network or radio and spoken as the chief executive of this government to the good people of the South, urging them to support the decision of the Supreme Court as the law of the land, whether they believed in it or not, and to use the full influence of his position as president to bring about peaceful solution of this problem. I think he was obliged to do that. And I think that his failure to do so does not help us at all, especially when we realize that as a result of the failure of the good forces to take over, we have allowed these other forces like the White Citizens Councils and the Klan to threaten and intimidate good people. Moral leadership should come from the top executive of the government. It's his responsibility, and he can't duck it.
And that is Thurgood Marshall. That was when he was a lawyer before he was appointed to the Supreme Court by LBJ many years later. He'd been interviewed by Mike Wallace talking about Eisenhower. We're talking about the Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall and the Groveland Boys and the Dawn of a New America, author of that Pulitzer Prize-winning work of nonfiction, in the studio, Gilbert King. And Gilbert King will be doing a reading and book signing tonight at Incarnate Word University. It's free, open to the public at 7:30 at the McCombs Center, Rosenberg Sky Room. And it's worth it to see you, just to see the room, to go see you and the room, because it's a beautiful room, a great view of the skyline.
I got a tour of it today, and I was like, I don't know how people are going to be looking at me when they could be looking out and seeing this view. I'm really worried about that. Let me get them to close the blinds, but it was absolutely beautiful. I'm really looking forward to it.
So that was Marshall talking very critically of Eisenhower. I'm not sure where we are in the timeline, because Eisenhower did send in the troops to take over the National Guard in Little Rock.
Right. I think that clip was from 1956, so it would have been just right before that. And it's interesting to listen to that clip now, because I just recognize, like, Marshall sometimes came across as a very strong guy, but you know, I listened to a lot of his Supreme Court arguments, and he's just very professorial. And I was listening to one of the post cases after Little Rock, and it was really amazing because he just sort of was basically teaching the Supreme Court how to rule on this case. And they were asking him questions almost as if he was the professor. And he's telling them how to rule, and sure enough, it was a 9-0 verdict. But it was just amazing to see someone in such command of that area of law before the Supreme Court, just to hear that. It was a really impressive argument.
And here we are today with the Roberts Court.
Right.
Is it? And it's, you know, recently ruled, taking down the Voting Rights Act, taking out an important section of it, and it's going to be a while before Congress gets around to fixing that section. But definitely we're seeing a rollback on some of the advances that we saw from the Marshall Court.
Yeah, it's really one of the things that the Legal Defense Fund is really focusing on, because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, we have a black president, we've had all these Supreme Court rulings, it's an equal society now. You're starting to see things rolled back. Voting rights took a major turn this year. There's an affirmative action case coming before the court. So you're starting to see a lot of, you know, adjustments with you taking advantage of this new sort of conservative Supreme Court. And so a lot of the things that Marshall fought for and won decades ago are being reexamined. So it's an interesting time in America.
Phone number to call in, join the conversation. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you, 614-8980, 614-8980. I want to talk about the other book that you wrote, which is also fascinating, the story of Willie Francis.
Willie Francis,
Willie Francis, the only person in America sent to the electric chair twice.
Right.
Southern Louisiana, a young man. He was convicted of a murder.
Right.
And then he was sent to the electric chair. What happened?
Well, it was one of these things in Louisiana. They had a portable electric chair. And so they'd
What was the name of the chair?
Gruesome Gertie. And they kept this thing up in Angola in a truck. And they would bring it around from Paris jail to Paris jail and execute people and then bring it back up. And so whenever there was a schedule, they'd send out a team of executioners. In Willie's case, unfortunately, there was some political upheaval going on at the jail. So all they really had was an inmate and a guard to go out and do this execution. These guys couldn't wait to get away from the jail. They went out, got drunk all night, were drinking in the morning while they were setting up the chair, and they basically set it up wrong. And so when it came time to pull the switch on Willie Francis in 1946, he got some electricity, but not all of it, and they couldn't kill him. So they let this machine run on him for 2 minutes and finally didn't know what to do with him, carried him back to his cell, threw him in there, called the governor.
I mean, wasn't he screaming, like, let me out of this thing while they're shocking
him?
And
he was saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And the sheriff is saying, you're not supposed to breathe. And he says, I'm not dying. And that was the last words he said in the chair. And, you know, it's just absolutely abhorrent. The governor's like, well, fix the chair and put him right back in. And they said, we can't fix the chair. So they gave him a 1 week reprieve. And that's when a lawyer stepped in and said, wait, this is double jeopardy. You can't just send a kid back to the chair.
And he was a good-natured young man who and evidently it looks like he did not commit the murder for which he was convicted of.
Well, that's the big debate. I mean, he worked as an employer of Andrew Thomas, this pharmacist. And as I discovered when I started going down there, you know, I learned that there was a little bit of what you might call his child abuse going on. Like he had a sort of a reputation of someone who was, you know, touching these kids. And so that was the rumor that was going around town. And so for some people, it wasn't a question of whether Willie did it or not. It was why he did it. He never denied it. But when I looked at the evidence, it just seemed strange that he could even get his hands on a gun, let alone.
It wasn't just a gun. It was the deputy's gun.
It was the deputy's gun. The deputy was a sworn enemy of this druggist. All five bullets struck the target. There's no evidence that Willie Francis even knew how to shoot a gun. Bullets were very expensive back then. No African-Americans had handguns back then. If they had guns, they were rifles for hunting. And so it was very strange to a lot of people that he managed to shoot five times and hit his target. So there was a lot of strange evidence in that case, and it was all brushed up and, you know, swept under the rug at the time.
We do have a caller. Let's get Cheryl on the line. Cheryl, welcome to The Source.
Hi. I read most of the book. I have to admit, it was a library book, and it depressed me and upset me so much.
I get that,
I couldn't finish it.
Yeah.
But I have my question is, you mentioned going through files, and I wondered, did you have access to all of the Legal Defense Fund files?
I had, yes. In fact, what's really strange is that these files had been held by the Legal Defense Fund, and I had heard stories. In fact, the New York Times ran an article with a lot of like Pulitzer Prize-winning historians and academics who were complaining that they couldn't get their hands on these LDF files. And so I kept at it for about 2 years, and for some strange reason, they gave me access to these files. And so that is what really enabled me to sort of be a fly on the wall during Marshall's deliberations with his staff to figure out a strategy. And so it was those LDF files that I had, and they gave me everything. And it was eye-opening because I had all the prosecution's material, I had all the FBI files, but I never really had the defense files until the LDF allowed me to have these. So I was very lucky in that case.
Thanks for that call, Cheryl. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 614-8980. So these files, they were sealed. Why don't they want to open them if they have all this great information? And if we don't have a chance to learn the history, then the history will be forgotten, right?
Right. Well, there was two different sets of files that I had a hard time getting access to. Number one was the FBI files. And these are the files which were really perplexing because you had all this exculpatory evidence like the missing bullet that was found in the soil. You would think that was something that the defense would like to get their hands on. But the FBI actually sealed all this and wouldn't let the defense see any of it. So they had
that was when J. Edgar Hoover was still there.
Right. This was J. Edgar Hoover. And basically, so they hid this evidence from the defense. So Marshall never had this evidence. And this was all the evidence where you had police officers giving statements and then going off the record, telling the FBI what exactly happened. So they were basically admitting to this violence on the Groveland boys.
Now, the girl who was 17 at the time when she said she was raped, she is still alive.
Right.
And in the course of the book, you went to go visit her. Tell us what happened.
I did. And that was, you know, I really felt like I owed it to readers, myself, and also to her to go down and interview her. And I went down and she was in the middle of Georgia in a very rural place. And
a trailer park?
It wasn't even a trailer park. It was two trailers that were basically in the woods in a very remote section of the South. And I went down there and an older gentleman answered the door and he said, well, I don't think she's going to want to talk, but we can try. And he brought me over there and she was literally about 6 or 7 feet away from me. And just sort of we went back and forth. I was explaining what I was trying to do. And ultimately, her message was, let sleeping dogs lie. She didn't want to bring it up. She didn't want to discuss it with me.
Okay. Wow. I want to thank you. I mean, that's an amazing story. And the way that you hunted a story down, you went to the records, you got the direct information, something that if you hadn't, do you think this would have been forgotten to the history?
It would have been forgotten, I think. You know, it was just one of those stories that it just happened to involve Marshall. And I'm not sure it's completely depressing. I think I find the ending pretty uplifting. So it even though it gets really dark, there is sort of this uplifting, this dawn of a new America.
And this has been optioned to become a movie that's being in pre-production right now.
Right, by Lionsgate.
All right. Well, I definitely want to thank Gilbert King. Gilbert King is going to be at Incarnate Word University tonight at 7:30, free and open to the public at the McComb Center, Rosenberg Sky Room. Awesome book. Great read. Thank you for coming up here.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Tomorrow, it's Texas Matters. Thanks for listening.